this week. The bull stampede in U.S. shares continued with the Dow Jones Industrials picking up 250 points and the NASDAQ within range of that former market record. Hello and welcome, everyone. It's just great to be back with you this weekend. Your host, Chris Waltzek, here with two more big guest interviews. Well, our top stock on the Alpha Stocks newsletter exploded this week. A little-known bank company, a financial institution, flew higher. We'd like for you to sign up, if you haven't already, to help support the show. Well, the discussion begins this week with Bob Hoy, the senior investment strategist of Institutional Advisors, rejoins the show. He thinks the precious metals sector is nearing a bottom and could enter a new uptrend in the years ahead. And then president and director of Gold Source Mines, GXS.V, Yanis Tsitos, makes his show debut. Peter Spina, the top gold stock analyst, says that this is the precious metal stock opportunity of 2016, and well, you saw what happened to the last candidate on the show, ticker SA Seabridge, we've been promoting for over a year, blasted higher from its lows, up over 100%. With 30 years of experience, President Tsitos knows how to make a small mining company into a world-class operation, and they've partnered with IAM Gold. And with a cash cost of just $630 an ounce all in, that's about half the spot price. This looks like what could be an extremely profitable precious metals company. And don't forget Robert Ian. He wraps up the show with his latest report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Well, heavy weather continued over the New York COMEX exchange this week amid hawkish comments from the latest comments from the Fed chair, as well as unexpectedly strong employment numbers. Gold gave back about $54, off a few percent, finishing at $1,087. Silver lost 84 cents, down over 5%, finishing the week at $1,470, while the XAU Gold and Silver Equities Index gave back 11% at $46. West Texas Intermediate crude gave back $2, about 4.5%. At 44 and 30 cents a barrel. The top story driving the precious metals sector this week clearly stemmed from the U.S. dollar rally. The Labor Department announced on Friday an unexpectedly robust employment report, which sent the greenback soaring. The addition of 271,000 jobs topped the median economist's forecast by roughly 100,000 new jobs. Average hourly earnings also climbed the most since the last recession over 6 years earlier. The number was nearly twice last month's figure of 142,000 in the non-farm payrolls. Fed Chair Janet Yellen also noted in a congressional hearing this week that a move on rates in December is a possibility if the economic data hold up, and held up it did. The news sent the greenback soaring to levels not seen in months as investors prepared for higher yielding U.S. bonds, notes, and bills. Traders boosted the odds of a rate increase next month to 70% from lower than 50% on Thursday. That was quite a jump in the Fed funds futures expectations. The two-year U.S. Treasury yield also climbed to the highest level since 2011, reflecting very solid expectations that the Fed will soon raise rates for the first time in 2006. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, as forecasted in previous reports, buying opportunities continue to materialize, but few signs of a bottom have shown up yet, so patience is advisable. Moving on to the Wall Street report. Sunny skies appeared over the New York Stock Exchange for the sixth week running. The Dow approached the 18,000 level, ending near 17,910, adding 246 points over 1.4% for the week, while the S&P 500 ended at 2,100, up 20, about 1%, and the NASDAQ picked up just shy of 100 points, 2%, finishing at 5,147. Investors' risk appetite increased sharply on much better than expected employment numbers, although the threat of higher rates does not bode as well for interest-sensitive shares. The idea of a mildly hawkish Fed amid a super strong economy certainly sent shares to within earshot of a new record. Solid jobs growth translates into fatter wallets and pocketbooks, higher spending, solid corporate earnings, robust economic figures, and the holiday season coming up. The net result, financial dynamite. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, the seven-component sentiment index blasted out of the extremely fearful zone into the neutral area and now to the greedy. The sharp advance over the past 2 months has been extreme, and I see some price momentum starting to wane. I expect the market to start a consolidation in the next few weeks. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio. We'd like for you to stay with us right here. Well, it's a pleasure to welcome to the show President and Director of Gold Source Mines, headquartered in Vancouver, Canada, Mr. Tsitos. Just excited to find out more about Gold Source Mines, which engages in exploration and development of mineral properties. The key company project, Eagle Mountain Gold, it's 100% owned in South America. In addition, Gold Source holds 23 coal mineral licenses in Saskatchewan, Canada. Welcome, President Tsitos.
Thank you very much for the invitation, and I'm very glad to talk to you.
Well, sir, we're happy to have you, and I wondered if you could outline your professional background and the reasons that led you to this exciting opportunity at Gold Source Mines, please.
Yes, I'm a physicist, geophysicist in background, and I have close to 28 years experience in the mining industry. I started as a young explorationist and going and working through the jungles of the world. But I was very lucky and privileged in my career to work for the biggest miner on earth, an Australian company called BHP Billiton, with whom I was for 19 years. So I was exposed into exploration for 11 different commodities worldwide, and have done business on the exploration and mining front in 32 countries. So I'm in the last 15 years, I'm living in Canada. I left the big mine in 2008 when I wanted to pursue kind of a junior venture capitalist kind of dream for me, built up a couple of new companies, and one of them is what is called today Gold Source Mines. We got extremely excited because in 2010 we recognized the value of a serious asset located in South America in a very friendly country called Guyana. And this is a gold deposit which we invested a specific amount of money, more than about $7 million in the last 5 years. On the exploration front, and about $6.5 million now on the development front in terms of making the mine. And obviously, by recognizing this value, we thought it's an asset that can grow over time to become a much bigger production level.
Well, we appreciate that interesting background of yours, as well as the overview. The top analyst here, precious mining sector analyst, Peter Spina, has chosen your company as the top opportunity aficionados. Before we delve into this exciting flagship property, the Eagle Mountain Gold Project, if you'd like to give a bit more of an overview on Gold Source Mine's strategic mission, some perspective on the growth and your plans to increase growth in that area to help this company maintain its trajectory as a leading precious metals company.
Yes, the vision of the company is to become a medium-sized gold producer. We are focusing at the moment all our efforts in this country, and especially this project called Eagle Mountain Gold Project in Guyana, because we see an easiness of extraction of gold and therefore a very quick return, because the gold mineralization starts from surface in a very easy soft rock environment. Before we reach the more difficult parts of the deposit, at least 7 to 8 years ahead of us. So we start what we call a phase development approach. In other words, we start with a phase one now development, and we have built a team of experts in Canada, but especially in Guyana, engineers that are mainly Canadian, American, and Guyanese, and obviously operators on the local front. So we have built up an exceptional team that has done this before in other parts of the world. In Indonesia, we had successes in Mexico, discoveries in South America, Ecuador, or Australia. So this team comes with a combined 250 years of experience. And I'm talking about the management, the officers of the company, and the directors of the board. So fundamental number one in these venture companies is to have a good team. And that's what people like Peter Spina or others that are very loyal to us, they have recognized the value that comes with the management team.
Oh, it's so important. The intellectual capital that the right minds bring along is essential. I wonder if we could turn more specifically to the Advanced Eagle Mountain Gold Project in Guyana. According to your company literature, this region is very mining friendly. It's English speaking. It's a very politically stable democracy. Goldsource completed a financing there, raised $7 million, most of which, of course, is geared for the phase one in the mining there on that project. Operating cost of $480 an ounce on gold, making it a very profitable venture. Please tell us more.
We managed to achieve in the last 18 months significant milestones in order to make this vision that I said before a reality as we go. And there is no better timing than discussing this thing now, because this is the beginning of the development as we speak now. These weeks we are commissioning the mine. So coming back 18 months ago, we completed an amalgamation between two entities. We did produce independent stage engineering reports that confirm the resource by third parties as it is required by the exchange, Toronto Stock Exchange Venture. We achieved a mining license, therefore permitting in Guyana to develop the deposit. We have done significant environmental studies, and most importantly, as you said, we managed to attract, in very difficult times, I would say, for this sector, an investment of $7 million by specific parties located in New York, Singapore, and Canada. We catapulted then with all this kind of money, project, team that we are building over the last 9 months into a construction phase. And this construction phase is now more or less at about 90 to 95%. We just put an announcement yesterday, a public news release out there, and I encourage people to check on cedar.com, www.cedar.com, where all the Canadian junior companies on the mining space present their news, or come to our webpage at www.goldsourcemines.com, where they can find the news release or any previous news releases and any technical reports or financial statements. What we announced yesterday, effectively, we said, yes, indeed, we are developing the project on time and on budget, if never say at the budget, what we budgeted about 9 months ago. So that's rare in this space. We are there starting next week with independent engineers of the people who produce the plant, which was bought in Canada, Mexico, United States, and England, are coming to Guyana, these engineers, with our own team to commission the mine. So we expect first gold to be produced before Christmas, and as we said to the public, within the Q4 of 2015. Completing your question, the big bet for us is to prove this concept. So we have put all these numbers out of independent engineering and internal engineering reporting that predict that given the economics of our project, the location, the cost of fuel, cost of labor, you know, all the parameters that go into making a mine and producing gold, that we target to produce gold on all-in cash cost under $500 to, as you said, $480 per ounce. And then if I load on that Canadian overheads, sustaining capital, and all the other expenses of the company, inclusive of legal costs, for example, everything, salaries, and so on, will go to less than $630 per ounce. Still to be proven, but that's what we are going to do in the next 6 months. We're going to come back to the market and prove these numbers, which will put Goldsource Mines into the lowest quartile on the cost production stage of gold.
You know, another interesting aspect of the Eagle Mountain Gold Project involves your strategic partnership with key shareholder IM Gold, a major player in the sector. I wonder if you could outline how this corporate affiliation is creating synergies for Goldsource shareholders.
Yes, it definitely created more synergies earlier in the phase of the project on the exploration side. We got a lot of some technology transfer and so on, but most importantly, the people like in IM Gold recognize that they like this investment and they haven't sold their stock, for example. They have been loyal with us. But even beyond them, I would say IM Gold now is not that big following the dilution that we took last year when we raised the $7 million. It's probably to a level of 5% on the company. management insiders, I would say, and that makes or gives comfort to any other investor that, you know, we believe that much in the project that we control about 16% of the company collectively. And at every round of financing, we are also purchasing some additional stock for ourselves. So, which means that this is a great project, and we believe in the long-run development of Eagle Mountain. But in addition to the goals of what it's going to do with all this cash flow down the line and so on, and the way we want to expand. Then we have a New York fund that controls another 15%, and some private equity in Singapore controls about 15%. And we have more than 700 shareholders in Canada and United States that are ranging on smaller amounts.
I wonder if you could outline the exploration efforts as well as coal resources located at the Gold Source border property.
The Saskatchewan border property, it's a coal property. It has nothing to do with gold, obviously. At the moment, it's an idle project, but the company spent a significant amount of money to discover the deposit. It was an own discovery. I mean, I would say, to be fair, it was before my time joining as the president of this company. But the management, other members of the management that are longer than me here, obviously played a significant role, like Eric Fear, our chief operating officer, who was, Scott Driver, fundamental in discovering the border property. This is energy coal. Obviously, the coal prices at the moment are suffering hugely into this market, and that led to the point where this project needed much bigger capital expenditure in order to move ahead. So we don't lose the property. We have titles that will be valid for quite some time, waiting for the right opportunity with any third party or ourselves exploiting that when we do have indeed some cash flow, free cash flow, to invest in additional projects beyond gold. So that's, but it's a significant resource, it's a massive project, can become a world-class deposit producing more than 30 to 50 years. But obviously, as you understand, big projects need big capital, and these times are very difficult for the mining space for people to achieve this big capital.
I wonder if you would be willing to provide any specific management decisions that you anticipate in the years coming forward that could offer your shareholders a strategic advantage.
Yes, that's a great question, Avalis. This is, in any business, your listeners will understand timing is everything. And that is not really, kind of defined within the mining industry or the venture capital industry, but timing indeed is everything. And there's no better time, as I said earlier, for people to do their own homework and understand the value or the real value of the assets we control and the way that the Gold Source management will drive this company. So we have specific milestones ahead of us. Milestone number one is obviously proof of concept on Eagle Mountain, and therefore moving to a full production stage. We expect 2016 year to be a full production. But the project, as I said, has been developed in a phased approach. In other words, more expansions will come in the next 3 to 4 years on a constant basis. So we do expect every 6 to 12 months, we put additional capital from free cash flow to initiate additional capacity. We start at about 1,000 tons a day production, and we will move to more than 4,000 to 5,000 tons a day within 4 years, as we have outlined in the independent engineering reports. At the same time, we want to improve recoveries of gold. In other words, we put better machinery, better processing plant or equipment on site, and rather than diluting shareholders for that, we thought we will get that out of free cash flow. That's why your previous question about $480 gold is so important to be achieved, because we want to exploit the profit margin and keep reinvesting this money into the project. So any shareholder or future shareholder here will see a constant appreciation of what's going to be the true output of this company. On top of that, obviously, opportunities will start be creating. On passive approach, people, come and talk to us already about acquiring or JV other projects. Or on proactive approach, we do have significant amount of network in this region, but worldwide too. We have some targets, but I learned from very young in my career to do small steps and do the bigger ones when we do have this capacity and especially the free cash flow. So we are very careful at the moment. We are focusing the development of Eagle. but no doubt we will, you know, expand on the business development side too, and get grab any opportunity that will create or enhance the vision here to catapult the company to medium producer scale. So in a few years, this company will be significant out there, and that's why people who come now at this kind of valuation, they will definitely see the reward when the amount of ounces is going to justify different price earnings ratios and so on.
President Sitos, as the discussion winds down here, do you have any other parting comments, perhaps any topicality that I have not mentioned today that you'd like to leave with the listening audience?
Yes, I would like to say a couple of things. First of all, Guyana, because not many people know about Guyana. As you mentioned earlier, it's an English-speaking country. Actually, it's the only English-speaking country in South America. It used to be a British colony. Used to be called, actually, British Guyana. And it's small in the map, but a big size, like size of United Kingdom country, occupied by 720,000 people. The resources extractive sector is one of the biggest, if not the biggest part of their GDP. So therefore, you understand the law, the local law is very pro-mining on this kind of front, but it is a law that's based on British standards, and therefore, even for us as Canadians here, we can protect ourselves. So, I mean, expatriation or profit or pay or dividends or some things down the line is no problem. So you're allowed to do anything, and even when we consolidate our books between our Guyanese subsidiaries and Canadian companies, you know, we have no problem because they are same accounting principles, okay? So it's a secular democracy, very stable, and there are no problems on this front from an environmental or social perspective, not accepting mining, for example. So it's a good benefit, and risk mitigation for us as management has been a very important thing here. And many people don't understand mining. Sometimes they think it's only about how much gold you have in the ground. I would say the biggest risks in this industry is how easily you take your gold out, especially the license to operate in a developing country. So we have covered ourselves, we have hedged ourselves on that front, and we believe very highly of the local environment. And the people that we have as Guyanese operators are very nice, educated people. I really like this country, and as you understand with my previous career, you know, I have tested, you know, numerous countries, and I do see that some of them stand out, and one of them is Guyana for sure. Infrastructure, we didn't talk at all, is great. The project is very close to an airstrip about 8 kilometers away. It's a big town of 4,000 people with an airport. We do have a road, so you know, we are not deep in the jungle. In other words, we can take gold out of our location with helicopter from our helipads or through a plane, a fixed wing, or we can move people very easily and equipment on the site, which obviously lowers your operating costs. So there are a lot of good benefits. I would like to encourage your listeners to check more about the company by going to our website, understand also the risks before they take any decision, understand the resource, the mineral resource that exists there. But we are very proud to say we have achieved a lot of things in the last 18 months. We had our heads down and working 12 hours a day to achieve what we want in the next 12 months.
And I just mentioned to folks, you can direct your web browsers to goldsourcemines.com. And that's all one word, goldsourcemines.com. There'll be plenty of links available for you if you'd like to visit their site. And bookmark it, please. The ticker symbol, GXS.V. Well, President Sitos, we'd just like to thank you for taking time from your corporate schedule today to share the details of this very exciting opportunity at Gold Source Mines.
Thank you very much, sir, for your time, and thanks to the listener for spending their time to listen to me.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the show Bob Hoy, advisor to institutional clients around the world over 30 years, chief investment strategist of institutionaladvisors.com. Welcome back, Bob Hoy.
Chris, good to be with you, and good to be with your listeners.
You know, it's a pleasure to have you back today, and a lot is happening around the world. An interesting story recently that the Venezuelan government has decided, in the wake of the late Hugo Chavez's decision to repatriate its gold. Now there is very serious talk about leasing, swapping, and otherwise doing away with their national stockpile of that barbarous relic, the yellow metal.
Yeah, well, I saw some of that, too. They got to settle some bills, and so they're going to have to realize some, you know, immediate cash-type money out of their gold position. And, you know, what a wonderful example they're providing of the results of intrusive government. You know, most of the time, the experiment in authoritarian government is in the Western world has gone on very slowly, you know, an incremental thing. And then with the recessions coming and going and whatnot, it sort of obscures the thing. But when they move real fast, like in Venezuela, you can actually, you know, it's much clearer to see the destruction they do, you know, because they can only get their consumption. The state's consumption can be unlimited, and the ability to fund the state is unlimited. And if they do the consumption thing real fast, then the instruction's there. And I wouldn't want to live there, but it's providing yet another example of the distortions and expense of interventionist government. You know, even the retail stores are not operating there. You know, I mean, it's so hopeless.
This is really the case study, isn't it? It's almost the petri dish. Kind of expect you to segue right into Argentina.
An authoritarian government in the United States, and now in Canada, we have the start of another authoritarian government in Canada, so people just can't stay away from it.
It seems to be this natural progression. I don't know if an adulteration of what should be, you know, an idyllic republic, if you will, or democracy. I know that originally it was a republic. There's a lot of debate over that now. It seems to upset people when you even bring up the term capitalism today, which is so funny because a few decades ago, that was what we were all proud of, I thought.
Yeah, people are running away from the term capitalism now, but what you want to do is take Mussolini's definition of fascism. And he said it was the combination of big business and big government. So then you've got now in the United States, definitely big business and big government, and the intermediary is Wall Street, and it's part of the corruption. So expand the definition of fascism from a combination of big government and big business to big government, big business, and big Wall Street.
And we also heard the European Central Banking Finance Minister, Mario Draghi, talk about lowering rates even further into negative territory.
Oh, yeah. Well, they, of course, know that the seasonality of the financial markets and that you can get things going wrong in the August to October period. And certainly the August crash surprised them. And you had the Shanghai index down more than 30%, which is, in the time period, a horrendous hit to the markets from which you would expect the market to find stability. But you can still have unpleasant things being discovered in the month of October. So early in October, we wrote that there could be a seasonality to central bank interventions, that if they're going to happen, they'll happen in October in order to the discovery of a, well, we know that the unemployment and employment numbers are rigged, but even with the rigging at the 1st of October, there was a report came out that was really bad. So then you had credit spreads widening and a whole lot of stocks and bonds and corporate bonds being hit. But that was really testing of the August 24th, Black Monday, and so then you saw the rebound coming out and the short squeeze developing, and then it turns out that the Treasury did, and Fed, I guess, part of it, a whole repo operations in the Treasury market that made the repo operations in 2008 look like nothing. So they had a massive intervention, and then, as you mentioned a little while later on, along came the European Central Bank, and then the Chinese Central Bank came in. But the one that was missing was the Bank of Japan. They didn't do anything. Now, the other day, I saw that they own half. The government in Japan owns half of the market in equity ETFs. So you could see where they would want to juice the market and get those up, but when it was there, the Bank of Japan's turn to juice the market, they didn't. So this is something that's worth watching. I mean, it's such a natural thing for an interventionist to get long the stock market and then think that they can drive it up. So something's going on that's interesting there. So.
Well, you know, we're also hearing from the Federal Reserve, the Chair Yellen, talking about delaying the first rate hike until May. If we look at the Fed funds futures contracts, it certainly looks like they have plans to keep delaying and delaying well into the new year.
Well, you know, me and Fed rate changes and manipulations, just forget about it. Don't even look at it because it doesn't matter. I think that the discussion for the Fed raising at an administered rate began about a year and a half ago, and I think it was to show that some sort of sense of responsibility when they were acting so recklessly, reckless central banking. So now it's totally out of the question. It doesn't matter whether the discount rate is raised or not. Now, the other thing that we often point out is that you go back to previous big financial bubbles, 1873 or the one previous in 1825, when then the senior central bank was the Bank of England, and after 1840s, the Bank of England could raise their interest rates to higher than 5.5%. So then you could really get some swings in interest rates. And the record is that when you're going into a bubble and rates start to go up, the central bank will be 4 or 5 months behind the rise in market rates of interest, like T-bill rates. And then when you get to the top, when interest rates start down in anticipation of the crash, the central bank will be 4 or 5 months behind that change. So just the straight empirical evidence, going back to the 1800s, says that the central bank will be behind the end of it when whatever interest rates do, the Federal Reserve will have been seen to be behind the action.
Exercise in futility, right? But I would like to throw into the ring a few little anomalous observations I've made, which I do think probably carry some interesting value with regard to the surprising change that I've seen at the CME Group's countdown to hike. They have an interesting Fed watch, they call it, the odds on the 30-day Fed funds futures contracts. And the odds are just basically what investors are betting, wagering on with regard to whether or not rates will increase or not. If we just look at the upcoming December 16th Fed meeting slated for just over a month from now, 5-6 weeks, you know, you're only seeing a 60% odds for a rate hike to half a point. That would be the first move since, I think, 2006. So we're approaching a 10-year hiatus. As we start to go out over the next year of rate hikes, which we'll see in 2016, you start to notice an intriguing trend. Investors are anticipating not only a rate hike to half a point, but now a rate hike to 0.75%. In fact, for June of next year, there is a 31.5% likelihood they're giving on a 0.75% rate. If you go to July, 20% chance that you'll be at 1% on the Fed rate. And then if we go just a bit further, there's 10% odds on a 1.25% rate increase. So that would be a whole 100 basis points above where we are now. And then if we go all the way to the end of their metrics in November 2nd, 2016, you see 13% odds on 1.25% and 4% on 1.5%. You can even make a bet way out to 1.75%, 2%, and even 2.25%, although they're pretty slim odds way out there. So implied volatilities are one of those few indicators that academia has proven is a highly reliable gauge of future activity. I think that it indicates we're going to see at least 0.75% by next year.
You know how that's going to, you know what will precede that? Market rates of interest going up, and
The
Fed will follow. But the important thing is to understand is that the Fed doesn't drive interest rates. Market does. So if you take a look, for example, at the action in the long Treasury bond, we use the ETF, the TLT, it soared up to a very good technical high early in the year as crude finished its collapse. Then it's done three lesser peaks then, but it's in a mode where we are now calling, or have been since the first of the year, for rising market rates of interest. So the treasury rates are going probably go up. Interest rates for lower grade stuff like junk bonds have been going up, and the Fed will be behind. They follow interest rates. Now when interest rates are going down, they can help them go down a little further, but the changes are in the hands of the marketplace, not in the hands of the policymakers. So you now have a trend of rising interest rates set by the market. It will be followed by the Federal Reserve moving their administered rate. And it'll be within the history of the senior central bank always following changes in market rates of interest. The market rates of interest turned in May of 1929 to down, and the Federal Reserve followed it in October of 1929.
Yeah, but there's a competing school of thought here who are convinced that the Fed's operations extend to some of the major investment banks who are in collusion with several markets by using very complex derivatives, swaps and things of that nature, may have a far greater sway. In particular, credit default swaps can have as much as 100-fold leverage or more, and it would seem to imply gold, silver, other markets, interest rate markets, and even the LIBOR, as we've seen, can be rigged. At least I've inferred from this information that the Fed may have a bit more sway than we're giving them credit for here on the markets.
The other thing that if you look at the history of financial markets is that while they can push short interest rates down a little for a brief period of time, they have absolutely zero influence on the on credit spreads, the difference between high-grade bonds and low-grade bonds. And when they're ready to turn, as they did in June earlier this year, and that's what set off, it was the turn to widening credit spreads in June and the breakout in the chart on widening credit spreads in July that pushed off the crash in Shanghai. So then the other one, of course, is the yield curve, and that's the difference between long-dated treasuries and short-dated. And they have, when it's time for that one to turn, have no influence on that either. So what you have now is that after the last hit to the markets, which ended on October 2nd, credit spreads have narrowed, you know, it was due for a correction. And on the chart, it's sort of at resistance here where probably we're close to the next point of widening credit spreads. And as I again emphasize, the Federal Reserve has very little influence on credit spreads. That is the market speaking, and the Fed can only hope to influence it. So this one, I don't know, maybe a couple of weeks from now we should see if the trend to widening credit spreads is back on. And if you look again at the history of credit spreads, when a turn is made on that, they're cyclical. And once they start turning, like to where they were narrowing into June, that's now on a cyclical turn to widening, that the Federal Reserve and all of those who believe that the Federal Reserve has infinite power will discover that, indeed, they has no power over credit spreads at all. Because the Fed on this one's going to be humbled, you know. You look at the all the literature that was with the formation of the Fed, you know, that book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. And their thesis was, in the early 1900s, that every recession was preceded by a convulsion in the financial market. So then they said, we can prevent, with a central bank, we can prevent the convulsion in the financial markets, and then there's no need to have recession. So the Fed opened its doors in 1914, January 1914. There hasn't been 19 recessions since. They dream that they can affect markets for the better. And the only thing they've been able to do is they have not changed financial history. The business cycle still comes and goes. You still get great bubbles and crashes. But the only thing they've been able to do is depreciate the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar. I guess it's down to 3% of what it was in 1914. And this is absurd, but it's ending action. What we're seeing with this latest bubble in lower-grade bonds, which is over, and in high-grade bonds, which may be over, and, of course, the stock market, which may be over as well, is that all they end up doing is getting bubbles, and they can never, ever prevent a bubble from collapsing. In previous experiments in authoritarian government, each one lasted for about 100 years, and they ruined the economy, and then the folks got common sense. And the first one was the 3rd century in Rome. When were the periods of experiments in authoritarian government? 3rd century, 16th century, and the 20th century, and it's still running. When were the periods in time when you had massive inflation? 3rd century in Rome, and 16th century, and then 20th century, and still running. So, but the two previous ones, they lasted for about 100 years plus. The folks got common sense. So this is what we're looking for now, is the next leg down in the financial markets and the next recession. Folks are going to say, hey, you took all our tax money. We're looking for a new bull market in common sense.
Fiat money inflation in France, it just left such an imprint on my mind, you know, Dixon White, of just what a devastating impact that monetary expansion, unbridled monetary expansion, can have on a society. And as you've mentioned on previous shows, you know, this is occurring now on an unprecedented scale globally. There never really has been a time in history where fiat money inflation in France had been exported globally to 150, 200 or more nations.
Oh, yeah.
Destruction of the morality or the moral structure within the fabric of society begins to become very evident. Gambling, what was once anathema, is suddenly embraced as the new exciting entertainment. Nations like the United States, Great Britain, can be eroded in just a generation or two, 20, 40 years or less, by this economic anomaly. Destructive impact can be felt for generations to come.
It's an old saying that great civilizations are born stoic and die Epicurean. And by stoic, we mean being tight and frugal. And by Epicurean, living the good life. And I would say also, I've used the line on bull markets. They begin stoic, like in 2009, and they die Epicurean, where we are now. So, and the idea that every depreciation of the U.S. dollar will drive gold up is behind the times. I would suggest that the Fed's recklessness is only allowed by the speculation that's been going on in low-grade bonds and in the stock market. So where you went back to, say, September 2012, when then Bernanke announced he was going to be buying bonds, and all the gold people went out and bought gold and silver because they thought that was going to be inflation. But that was their notion of inflation. What happened was is that bond prices got inflated and until recently. And, of course, stock prices got inflated until recently. Our outlook now is that we're still looking for the base or the precious metals to. It's a basing process. Gold, the gold stocks divided by gold, it needed to improve, and it did. And about 5 weeks ago, it broke above the 50-day moving average, and that popped the rally. And so we're fortunate that it didn't do do a straight-up rally like it did coming out of Christmas last year. But what this more gradual-type rally is showing is that a lot of the bulls that were around are no longer around. So then what we're looking for is a new bull market for the precious metal sector, but based upon a new paradigm. And actually, the paradigm's not so old, it's not so new, Chris, because it's the same thing that happened in the previous post-bubble contraction, where the price of most things fell relative to gold. And gold's real price went up, and profitability came back into the gold mining business. And so this is where we watch it. Of course, some of the calculations on the U.S. CPI are suspect, so we just do it against a commodity index, and it's been improving a lot. And so once the mistakes made on the old paradigm are washed out of the system, like that peaked in 2011, and I take that as a peak of 50 years of gold bug stuff and central bank stuff, that the Fed is evil, the dollar will go down and gold will go up forever. That maxed out in 2011, and you had, so this is all being washed out of the system. But the way we look at it is that investors will be watching the real price of gold and will be watching for profit margins to increase. And in each of the past long post-bubble contractions, the real price of gold has done very well, even when the price was fixed, like in a lot of the 1800s in England. And the gold mining will start making money. Here, look at, in 1930-31, you could have bought Homestead for, let's say, $9. So at the end of 1932, the price of gold was still $20.67 an ounce. But their earnings were up something like 130% because the real price had gone up, and the stock was up 130% as well. And at the end of 32, you were looking at a very bad Dow Jones New York Stock Exchange kind of market. It was a disaster. So the gold stocks were absolutely outstanding. And then, of course, Roosevelt got onto the trend and then raised the price of gold to $35 an ounce, which increased the real price even more, so that eventually in the mid-1930s you had Homestead up to $64, and it was paying $4.50 a share dividend each year on a $9 purchase. So this is where we are long-term bullish on the gold sector, but it'll be on the post-bubble contraction, whereby gold does better than most other things. So
you feel that, this correction we've seen over the past few years, going on 5 years in the precious metals, it could be nearing an end.
Oh, yeah. I think it's bottoming as we speak, Chris. And the thing is entry here. Now, it looks like this rally out of October 2nd in the big stock market is about run its course. Oh, we've got to make an announcement here. We've got a new indicator. We're going to call it the Christmas Bonus Indicator. So we took the broker-dealers index, that's called XBD, and of course that's where all of the underwriting fees and all the hot action in the financial market has been focused, and it's now giving a sell signal that's similar to 2007 and then before that 2001. So considering it's going into Christmas, and if the broker-dealers index heads down, it's going to be saying, hey, the profitability is going out of the broker's business, and the Christmas bonuses may not be all that good. So when we get it finished, we'll send you a copy.
We will look forward to that. Now, when we talk about the broker-dealer index, you're essentially talking about brokers and dealers in the United States, and there is, for folks that are listening, an ETF now, that's IAI, Indigo, Alpha Indigo, the Dow Jones U.S. Brokers Dealers Index on the New York Stock Exchange. Index itself has really turned the corner over the past month or so, most likely juxtaposing the index against another metric.
Yeah, well, what we did is just, in this case, we're using another index, the XBD and it made its peak in June and got hit hard into August, rebounded, and it's right at the upper Bollinger Band now. So then we look at the peak in 2007, and hey, very similar with the same moving averages. And then we looked at 2001, and it's similar there. So we expected a rebound into here to get up to the upper Bollinger line, and it has, so it's now vulnerable. And it was just the other day I came out with the quip that if the broker-dealers heads down, that means the whole brokerage side and Wall Street will be contracting. Therefore, the bonus pool may not be as great. So then that's where we're going to call it. It rebounded to the moving average, and it's beginning to retreat from it. So if we look at, let's say we'll look at it next week and it's down somewhat, then it's heading in the right direction following the path of 2007.
And you feel that this indicator likely sheds some light on the economy, or are we talking about the U.S. equities indexes?
If the brokerage business is heading south, the whole markets will be heading south.
I'm looking at it now. I'm looking at least the IAI ETF, sort of juxtaposing it against the S&P 500. And I do find a very startling indication here. It was relatively weaker than the S&P 500 before the big smackdown we had a couple of months ago. Can't help but notice that it has been lackluster relative to U.S. equities during this, let's call it a recovery or a nascent recovery.
Oh, yeah. The rebound since the 1st of October has been weak compared to what the NASDAQ up to new highs. And the financial side has been weak, which is not good. Also, the low on 2nd of October was 158 on the XBD compared to the low on the crash day, August 24th, was 162.
The diamond pattern, which we've now in retrospect see all over the place before the collapse of 2 and 3 months ago in equity, I don't know about collapse, but major sell-off, is much more pronounced than almost any other index that I've looked at, with maybe the exception of the bio. It's interesting because it gives such an important clue to future potential activity. I would have been very wary had I looked at this before that time period. I'd have thought, wow, maybe there's more going on here in this nearly year-long consolidation in equities.
Well, actually, we had another amusement with the banks in July when we did a chart on Wells Fargo. It was the one that was acting the best, and it had done some technical stuff. So we brazenly came up with the headline for it is that institutional advisors initiates coverage on Wells Fargo with a widows and orphans short. It applied for the sector, the banking sector, but we felt that it was so obvious.
Bob, what I find interesting here, when I look at the IYF for the financial sector ETF, it did not give in any way, shape, or form the technical hints many of us listening would be looking for, but that IAI, what a remarkable indicator. And my suggestion there would be a very few eyeballs on this index, on this sector. And as you say, has an interesting forward-looking aspect to it due to the bonuses and whatnot that you referred to.
You know, we like to, where possible, if there's something amusing and you can get a quip out of it, we like to do it. And as I said, that widows and orphans short was one.
Any other topicality? My guess is as we wrap up here today, there might be something else you're watching closely. For instance, interesting article noted that the middle class is simply disappearing due to challenging economic issues we're facing here. Consumer bifurcation. Don't you love that?
Quite a word, but you know, the middle class has been preyed upon by governments because that's where the money is. And we know that, and if you read Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals, you'll realize that the way you destroy the middle class in the United States, why anybody would want to do that, I don't know, but at any rate, you destroy them by overwhelming the welfare system. This, again, to go back to the 100-plus years of experiment and authoritarian government, I take this to be ending action. Same movement in the early 1600s in Europe, and particularly in England, got out of the experiment and authoritarian government in the best way. Then, of course, then after the 3rd century in Rome, it just the whole state started to collapse.
Can you extrapolate on a forward basis how you would anticipate this experiment, as you call it, an authority, to unravel? Can this have a positive outcome, and how much pain will be required first?
The expansion of the state depends upon currency depreciation and credit expansion. The U.S. dollar has been firm to steady. That will begin to undo the experiment, and then you now have a bear market going for low-grade bonds. That then is another one. So the financial market coming down would mark the end of the experiment right now, these next few years. The whole political attitude could change. Now, here is there's two things that the state has been involved with. One is promoting the notion that it can manage the economy. Okay? This, on the next recession, more and more folks are going to say, hey, that's not working. This is what I call the new bull market in common sense. Now, then the other great promotion by the state has been that it can manage the climate. You know, in the history of big governments, it's always been to manage the immediate people. And no government in history had ever taken on the idea that they can manage the climate. So then you have flatlining in the advancement of global temperatures as measured by satellite now for 18 years. And the idea that man caused global warming through carbon dioxide is absolutely absurd. So, of course, the challenge out there is that the state has assumed that it can manage the climate, but the only reason why they're doing that is because how are they going to do it? Increased regulations and increased taxation, and that's all what it's all about. So over the next 4 or 5 years, the public will see that the state cannot manage the economy. And the state cannot manage the climate.
Okay, but as we kind of run this football across the field line here, can you give us an idea whether or not the nation states, if you will, of Europe, whether or not the 50 states or so, 48 contiguous states of the United States, whether or not the provinces of Canada, are they still viable as independent entities that could work together regionally as this federal system you're referring to implodes?
Oh, yeah, you got it right there, because after the experiment in collectivism, the initiative goes back to the individual and regionalism. Look, you got the split in England with Scotland peeling off. So then the power goes away from the collective and back to local hands, and that'll be really very constructive. So I think that the next leg down in stocks and bonds and the economy, the folks are going to wake up and say, hey, it's not your power is not working, and we're going to start to take our government back. They'll also take money back from the experts by insisting on a gold standard at some point.
Having sustainable alternatives for income, wealth preservation, food, and related sustenance is going to be key to any type of survival, let alone prosperity in the future. And that has, I think, profound implications for hundreds of millions of souls here in North America, as well as Europe, China, and other industrialized or semi-industrialized nations. Because this is a sea change from the big state providing for everyone to the big state can't even provide for itself.
That's right. You got it nailed, Chris. You can get into the website at institutionaladvisors.com, or actually easier way, just Google my name, Bob Hoye, H-O-Y-E, and it comes up. And we're always very willing to have a free introductory trial period, 4 or 5 weeks, and if you like it, you can take the service. But the website's worth taking a look at.
Bob Hoye, thank you, sir.
Good to be with you.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. There is a truism in the art of advertising and persuasion that says an idea, repeated often enough without contradictory evidence, will be accepted as true. Mainstream media often reports a certain mantra on financial matters within narrowly acceptable parameters of debate. One of those mantras that has been discussed from multiple perspectives on this broadcast is the idea that the Fed is going to raise interest rates in the very near future. And here's the latest evidence to support that premise. This expectation, which is repeatedly set and reset from Fed meeting to Fed meeting, is always abandoned at the last minute when rates are not increased. But sure enough, when a guaranteed rate increase is abandoned for some unanticipated reason, it's back on the agenda for the next meeting, and the expectation game continues ad infinitum. This week was no different again. The headline on MarketWatch screamed that there are 7 charts showing how Friday's supposedly amazing jobs report rocked the market, and a December rate hike now appears likely. Before I discuss this report, let me say there will not be any rate hike in December, or in 2016 for that matter. In fact, there will be no meaningful rate hikes, period, because the debt is too high, incomes are stagnant, and this ongoing game of bluff the public into thinking the economy is strong with the ever-anticipated rate hike is pure psyops in an ongoing game of psychological financial warfare. Here are the supposedly all-important reasons that Janet Yellen will increase interest rates in December. The October jobs report showed that the U.S. economy created 271,000 jobs in October, surpassing economists' forecasts, while the unemployment rate fell to 5% from 5.1%. And hourly wages rose at their fastest year-over-year pace since 2009. These reports often get corrected without any spotlight in the weeks following a big media splash. Do you really think that 271,000 jobs were created? Is unemployment really at 5%? What about the U6 unemployment number, which is rarely reported? Or John Williams of ShadowStat's more accurate analyses? The CME Group is pricing in a 70% probability of a rate hike, which is more than 10 percentage points above what it was earlier this week, when that probability stood at 58%. Another reason cited is that the euro sunk to a 6-month low on Friday after what the article calls a blockbuster jobs report. Blockbuster is a loaded word implying what is likely to be a surefire result. MarketWatch reports that traders and market strategists now expect the Fed to raise interest rate at its December meeting, and another rate hike could follow as soon as March. Nothing fair and balanced in this financial script. In fact, any opposing point of view is conveniently omitted. Another reason cited is that the dollar rose to a 2.5-month high against the yen, and it is suggested the dollar will likely continue to strengthen against the yen as long as investors are expecting the Fed to hike rates in December. Notice the hidden escape clause in that language. As long as investors are expecting the Fed to hike rates in December. Mark my word, something will happen between now and then that will stunt those expectations, at least temporarily, so the illusory rate hike gets pushed back to the future once again. How many years has this nonsense been going on? Too many. Treasuries spiked and gold dropped. Energy dropped and bank stocks spiked. All heralded as definitive expectation management for a surefire rate hike in December, which will not occur. Now, it is possible at some point the Fed will realize that some savvy consumers of financial information have gotten fed up with the Fed crying wolf about rate hike expectations. At some point, we may get a teeny tiny rate hike to shut the critics up. But I guarantee you, if that happens, it will only be done to reset the clock for the next half a dozen years of imaginary rate hikes that are promised but never delivered upon. Chris, I'd like to urge all of our listeners to sign up for my email list at conquerchange.com. And if any of our listeners are ever involved in bringing in keynote speakers or entertainment for their companies or professional organizations, especially during this holiday season, please visit my companion website at robertian.com, where I have a new video posted with condensed highlights from my stage hypnosis show. And until next time, this is Robert Ian, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at Conquer Change. Thanks, Chris.